Yes, Julianne. Nice, nice to hear your voice.
Yeah, and you too. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Is this okay with you if I record the call, or?
That's fine.
Yep, great. I think we should be fine. My signal seems quite good and everything like that. So has New York returned a bit to normality after the storm?
Yeah, well, there's still a lot of after effects in terms of buildings down, lack of electricity, all kinds of things, but not so much in Manhattan, more on the coastline, Long Island, Staten Island. But we're slowly recovering.
Yeah, it was pretty. It looked very extreme from the.
It was extreme. Yeah, it was extreme.
Yeah, scary stuff.
Uh-huh.
So I'll just begin. So I think you know a little about the project.
Yeah.
And. So, well, I'll just begin with just the sort of the data consent.
Yeah, I have your questions in front of me.
Great.
And it says here, first, please tell me about your earliest memory of encountering computing technology.
Exactly. Just before we go on to that, I just want to, I know you said that you didn't have any sort of special copyright requirements, but I just wanted to quickly just go through that with you to make sure that you're happy about that.
Oh, okay.
And so basically, so what I have is a Creative Commons copyright form. So basically, you keep the copyright, naturally, but you would agree that you would allow for the interview to be perhaps hosted on the Hidden Histories website.
That's fine.
And or else, and what I think will definitely happen is that that it will be published. So I've published 7 interviews that will be coming out next week in Digital Humanities Quarterly, or not next week, in the next couple of weeks. And so I think hopefully your interview will be in the second batch of those. And so basically the form just says that you'll get, if you agree to do that, then I just will make sure that you'll see the proofs and get to approve the proofs and everything like that before it's published.
Yes, I do approve.
Great. Okay, so what I'll do is I'll also email you the consent form for your own records.
Okay.
And if you can just post me a signed copy of that, when you get a chance, but the fact that we've discussed it and everything now, so that should be fine.
Okay.
Great. Okay, so let's go on to the questions. Yeah, so exactly, the first one was about your earliest memory of encountering computing technology.
Yeah, it's a complex story, and I tried to make it very brief. It's been a while ago. In fact, it was about 1968, 1969, I was at the Modern Language Association. Do you know that organization?
I do, yeah.
Okay, the MLA at that time was in the process of introducing a computer, mainly to help with administrative tasks. And I was a research assistant at that time at the organization, having come from Switzerland just a year or two before. And I heard about the arrival of the computer, and a whole staff was hired, operator, punch card operators, programmers, etc. And I had nothing to do with it. I was doing a study on the teaching of German in high schools. And but then the computer arrived. It was 360/20, which was the smallest in that famous 360 line. And the preparations were ongoing. And then there was a small scandal at the organization with the head of computing, as we called it then, having had a romantic liaison with the woman who was hired to be the operator. And the head of the president of the MLA was very offended by that. He was a son of a missionary, and he fired everybody connected with the computer. And so it just came to a standstill. And he called me up and said that I saw in your resume that you worked in a Swiss bank, so you're probably good with numbers. And would you like to make a go of it and try to help us with this new computer? It was a huge, at that time, a computer filled the room with a double floor and extra air conditioning. And I said I would think about it, thought about it, and I said yes. And went to instructions. That's really leading into your second question. Did you receive formal training in programming of computing? At that time, the IBM customer service was excellent. And I took courses in operating equipment, programming at that time, and began to... the work. The first task was to convert the membership list, the address list of about 30,000 members, which at that time were still on a what we called an addressograph machine. And it was all metal plates, and those were all key punched, all punched into cards, and so that was my beginning.
And this is about 1968.
That was about 68, right?
Did you go somewhere to take the training, or?
Yes, IBM had in Manhattan a classroom building, and I took courses with. Usually, we were a group of about 15 to 20, first in operating and then in programming. And I took those. And we successfully converted the membership list and went on to other administrative tasks. And within a year or so, we had it up and running.
Okay. I know that... that later, I think that later in your time at the MLA, that you'd worked on electronic reference tools.
Yes, well, that was a parallel development. As we worked on converting to computers, all the administrative tasks, accounting, budgeting, membership services, etc., we also had an outside firm compose the MLA International Bibliography. By composing, I mean it was a computer typography where we would prepare a tape with all the typesetting codes, and they would then set the type from this tape. And that then, I'm now sort of moving through the 70s, we did that for a few years, produced the International Bibliography, which was at that time the largest reference work for English, foreign languages, folklore, and linguistics. And then I'm skipping a few years now. Of course, we also looked into the possibility of making this available online. And that leads to another anecdote. When we worked at that time with a company, Lockheed, the airplane manufacturer in California, they at that time, early on, they made databases available for online searching. And it then became Dialogue. I think it's still Dialogue. But we were then the first, the MLA was the first organization to make a reference work in the humanities available online. And I remember very well, we produced the tape, stripping it of all photograph composition codes, and I had it under my arm, one of those large tapes, you know, the old tapes. I don't know if you recall those.
No.
They were quite large, about 15 inches in diameter diameter. So they were called the 7-track tapes. They were quite big. And I had that under my arm and took a plane to Palo Alto, to San Francisco, drove to Palo Alto to Lockheed, and gave them the tape. And they made it available online as the first international, first database in the humanities. And I remember so well, I flew back to New York and we bought one of those early online terminals. It was not really a terminal, it was a telephone with two rubber receptacles that you dialed the number and you put the receiver in those rubber
receptacles, exactly.
And then you typed in your search query, your and or, and I remember I jumped with joy when the first results came in, and I marveled aloud that this is from 3,000 miles away. And I get the answers that I requested. Of course, the searching was nowhere near the sophistication of today, but it worked. It worked.
Yeah.
And then that proved to be very successful. And then I negotiated. Now we're moving into the late 70s, early 80s. I negotiated with the Wilson Company in New York, was a publisher of articles and books for the library world, and the Wilson Quarterly, among others, they also had an online service, and we produced then the first CD with the MLA International Bibliography to be made available through Wilson. So that was all very exciting for our membership, and the uses increased. We got royalties, and it was a success, as I recall.
It's wonderful. I don't want to ask you too many sort of additional questions, because I know that we agreed the questions in advance. But if I could just ask you, if I could just ask you one that just sort of occurred to me. You mentioned that about 68, when the MLA, when the first computer arrived, that it was very much imagined that it would be used for administrative purposes. And that over time there was obviously that shift to getting the computer to serve more research ends or research-oriented ends.
Right.
And would you be able to reflect just a small bit on that shift and maybe whether you were aware of a wider context to it as well?
It was really through reactions in the membership when I became aware of a lot of work being done with the aid of computers, word concordances, frequency studies, authorship tracking, and we began to dabble in all of this, but not very seriously, because most of that work was done at universities, and I saw my role as an enabler, and that goes on to another question. Very early on, I think that was also in the mid-80s, end-80s, there was a very active group of people within the MLA dealing with computers and the humanities. That was also the time that the journal came out, Computers and the Humanities, and we organized an association of computers and the humanities. I was on the board, and they were looking at first for an opportunity to meet and to talk about issues and to plan next steps. And I made the conference room of the MLA available to a small group. And that turned out to be the founding, the beginning of the text encoding initiative, the TEI. Yeah. You may have heard of that.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so the early beginnings of TEI were really at the MLA in a conference room that I made available to that group.
That's really fascinating.
Well, and that also I talked about those early days. There's a question: which people particularly influenced you, and how? I would like to mention Joseph Raven. I don't know if that name has if you have come across that name.
I have. I've contacted him, and I hope to interview him as well.
I think you should.
Yeah, I've sent him questions.
Yeah, I don't know. I think he's retired by now, but he was the person that influenced me greatly. He was a professor at the Queen's College. He founded the journal Computing and the Humanities. I was also active in the association, and he and I worked very closely in those years in another aspect that I think I should mention, and that is that the MLA has an annual meeting, a fairly large gathering of its members. It usually draws about 10,000 members, and parallel to that convention, we had book publishers publish. We had a huge exhibit of scholarly books. And early on, Joseph Raven and I felt that it would be very interesting to have some computer-related activities at that exhibit. At that time, there was a lot of talk about computer-assisted education, computer-assisted teaching, computer-aided teaching, it went by all kinds of names, and we invited hardware manufacturers, software publishers and related industries to exhibit at the convention. And I visualized at that point that maybe this will be so successful in the next couple of decades that the computer-related exhibitors would outnumber the traditional book publishers. Well, it didn't quite happen that quickly, but we had maybe three or four. I remember Apple was one of the first to agree to come. But now when I look at the convention program, what is now 30, 40 years later, I notice that there are quite a few now, maybe 30, 40. They're still not in the majority, but getting there.
Yeah.
And that's where I mean, Joseph Rabin and I worked on that very intensively, and he was a huge help because of his contacts and his knowledge.
Yeah, absolutely. And what about then your sort of, you've mentioned about the TEI and your earliest sort of engagements with the conference community. Does a particular event sort of stand out? I guess where you had the sense that there was a community being formed, as it were.
Yes, that indeed. There was a hardcore group of about 10 people, that, of course, grew over time. But my real involvement with the conference community was a bit later. We're talking now about the 90s and later, when I became a senior advisor to the Mellon Foundation, and that was is I'm still doing that in the program called Scholarly Communication and the Technology Information Program. That's where I really became involved in all kinds of projects, not only here but also abroad. Some of them very sophisticated, digitization of manuscript collections, medieval manuscripts, infrastructure problems, projects like Bamboo. That grew. But while I was at the MLA, I just had peripheral contact with the group that was involved in computing and the humanities.
Okay.
But you can I just go on your list? Because
of course. You're
asking a very interesting question. One of the questions is, what about scholars who were not using computers in their research? Do you have the same sense of what their views about humanities computing were? Yes, indeed, I do, on several levels. First of all, I experienced a lot of hostility early on in the late 60s, early 70s, from the comments along the lines of computers have no business in humanities disciplines. Computing is a scientific instrument. And we don't want to have anything to do with it. And that, of course, changed over time with more and more people getting involved in computers and research. But the interesting thing was that at that time, it was very difficult to get any kind of recognition for computing work in the scholarly community, and that I think that's still a sore point today. That any kind of work be that research with the help of the computer, or the creation of software, or anything related to computing, at that time anyway, got very little recognition. And the desire, of course, of the computing community was to get the same kind of recognition that you would get by having an article published in a peer-reviewed journal.
Mm-hmm.
But that was not the case. But then slowly it began to change, and that I think today you get a little more recognition, but I also, by reading the literature, I realized that we're not quite there where it's the equivalent of a peer-reviewed article.
Yes.
That was my experience. But the hostility against computing early on in the 60s was profound.
Why do you think that started to reduce?
I beg your pardon?
Why do you think the hostility became less as time went on?
Oh, I think by sheer force of the evidence and the growth of the industry, and the fact that you couldn't argue with it anymore, and that it really it proved that it can be a very useful tool, and the field of computer-aided instruction really missed the boat a bit, because at that time it announced itself as something totally new that will replace the teacher, that you have to be with it, otherwise you're out of it. That proved to be absolutely not the case, because the teachers were as important as they were always, as they always were, and the computer was just a help in teaching, and of course now things have developed in so many other ways that the field as such really ceased to exist.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I don't want to keep you for very much longer, because your interview's been so fascinating. There was one thing that occurred to me after I'd sent the questions, and that I read about your work with the Engineering Information Foundation as well.
Yeah.
And I noticed that one of the part of the mission of that is also in terms of the recruitment of women.
Yes, that's one of our missions.
I was wondering if you might say just a little bit about that, and I was also thinking if you would have some reflections on the role of women in the area of computing and the humanities also.
Uh-huh. Well. I never had the prejudice that women can't be as effective as men, if not more effective, in computing and the humanities. But through my work at the EIF, where we have it as an explicit mission to support women. I mean, girls really, 12th graders. 11th grade, to choose an engineering career is because of the dismal rate of women in engineering. It's lower than 20%.
Yeah.
And it was recognized by many studies that had something to do with the environment. That there was a bias against women in engineering, and that was exemplified by comments by teachers, by other students, that just the atmosphere was not very welcoming. And that's one of the things we're trying to change. And so that we're giving grants to the so-called STEM programs, science, technology, engineering, mathematics, to change the environment in the classroom, to change and to do also much more work in how to retain, equally important, how to retain women once they have started on an engineering career. And so we're working on this. So far, we have been reasonably successful. The topic is being discussed. It's being recognized. Larger organizations have taken up the cause, and we continue giving grants to organizations that do have innovative programs in helping to attract and retain women in engineering. So, my regard for women's work in engineering, computing, mathematics is extremely high. After all, I'm the president of the foundation, so.
Yeah, exactly.
I think my views are well known.
Yeah. Do you think the sort of digital humanities area has been, how does it fare in terms of attracting and keeping women?
I think very well. This is really. What I'm saying now is more anecdotal than documented. I work with a lot of groups here and abroad in digital projects, digital manuscript projects, digital this, digital that, and also earlier in projects dealing with what we used to call library automation, where card catalogs were being converted to digital form or to computer readable form. And in those groups, I think the majority of the people that I've met were women, showing an enormous not only capability, but also an interest in the work they were doing. So that in that sense, it's become, I think that the digital humanities, come to think of it, the digital humanities projects that I've had to deal with, they really did not have the preponderance of men that you would expect in a scientific environment. In fact, the majority were women.
Yeah.
And very effective women.
Yeah, it is interesting, isn't it?
It's really. I think it's different than the traditional engineering field. There we have a slow going in changing the atmosphere, the climate, but in digital humanities, I believe we didn't fall into the trap in the first place.
Nice.
We managed to stay out of it.
Yeah.
Luckily. I haven't thought about that, but it seems to be true.
Yeah, that's a very interesting observation, though.
Yeah.
But yeah, as you say. Okay, is there anything else that you'd like to discuss, or is there any questions that you have for me before we
No, but now that I, it, you know, the talking about it brings back so many memories. And quite a few years ago, very fascinating. And I'm glad to be still involved in now what I would call the advanced computing and the humanities. But I would like to have the right to add to what I said as I continue thinking about it.
Yeah, that would be great. Actually, I wanted to ask you if you would agree to a second interview.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I'll think about it too. And I, some other things may come to mind. But I think, coming back to George Rabin, that if you can interview him, that will be fantastic. He may even remember me.
Yeah, I'll tell him that I interviewed you as well when I email him again. Yep. Over the next couple of days. And if I come back to you, when should I contact you again?
You can really contact me any time. I mean, if you want to, I'll be here. We have a holiday next week, and that is Thursday and Friday, the 22nd and the 23rd. That's Thanksgiving day, and I'll be out for that next week. And the week after, I have a 2-day meeting at Mellon. We're bringing together, in fact, that should interest you too. We're bringing together, it's called the Mellon Information Technology Projects Meeting. We're bringing together all the projects, the principal investigators of projects that deal with information technology, all digital projects really, to talk about issues of interoperability, sustainability, and working together. One of our big problems is that people in research infrastructure projects like Project Bamboo, Shared Canvas, Integrated Digital Papyrology,
yeah.
Can't even that they work together, because even though they have unique aspects to their projects, there is a whole lot in the infrastructure on the platform that can be shared.
Yeah.
I'm talking about, I don't know if these names are familiar to you, like
absolutely.
Archive,
yeah.
Space, collection space, conservation space, research space. All these groups are working on platforms, really, for digital projects. And anyway, and back to the calendar. We have a 2-day meeting with all these leaders next week on the 28th and the 29th. But other than that, I should be available. In early December, I'll be at a 2-day meeting in Raleigh, the Global Library Forum. That's about the new role of libraries internationally in terms of special collections and the like. But anyway, look at the in between. I'm always available. Do you want to set a specific date?
Dates are always good,
yeah.
Because otherwise my calendar tends to get filled up. Say if I contacted you maybe the week beginning the 10th of December.
Let me see. That should be that's fine. In fact, that whole week, I should be here.
Great. Maybe the what I'll do is I'll contact you the week 10th of December and we'll see what our availability is, and then it would be great if we could get one more interview in that week.
Okay, that's great.
Yeah.
That's great. Okay, well, I hope I was able to add a little bit.
No, that was wonderful. Thank you.
Early days.
It was great. And in the meantime, I'll already send your interview off to, I've got an RA on the project for another couple of weeks. And so I'll send the interview to her, and we'll already send you the transcript of this interview, hopefully in the next few weeks
okay.
as well.
That's fine, yeah.
Okay, well, thanks so much. It was really fascinating and really informative.
Okay, I thank you for your listening.
Well,
okay, bye-bye.
Bye.